The Bitcoin Standard Toolkit is a selection of Bitcoin services I recommend to my readers and learners on SaferDean.com as they upgrade their monetary operating system from the fiat standard to the Bitcoin standard. These companies are NYDIG, a leading full-service financial services firm dedicated to Bitcoin, applying institutional wisdom and ingenuity to help clients access the unrealized potential of this emerging asset class. NYDIG offers the full suite of solutions needed for financial institutions to access Bitcoin, including custody, execution, financing, treasury solutions, integration partnerships, and more. The team behind NYDIG brings decades of experience in the financial markets and passion for sound money to help provide the rails that will bring about a move to the Bitcoin standard. I have been working as a consultant for NYDIG for 2 years now, and I'm very impressed with their vision, focus, and execution. Go to NYDIG.com to learn more. CipherSafe. To secure your Bitcoins, it is important to keep your seed phrase backed up safely, and for that, I highly recommend using the CipherWheel Seed Storage Device, a gorgeous and brilliant sturdy piece of low-time preference engineering from a fourth-generation machine shop in Maine. The CipherWheel is machined from solid stainless steel, and its unique and elegant design is inspired by secret decoder rings, as well as legendary mechanical engineer Franz Rouleau and the golden age of machine design. If you've read the Bitcoin Standard, you'll know I think the late 19th century was a golden age for many facets of human advancement because of hard money. Bitcoin is bringing hard money back, and our friends at CipherSafe are giving Bitcoin the low-time preference machines it deserves from the golden age of design. Go to CipherSafe.io to get the CipherWheel for your Bitcoins. OKCoin. Whenever someone asks me how to invest in Bitcoin, my advice is to accumulate Bitcoins periodically for the long run, or what is called dollar cost averaging. When you buy every day, week, or month, you channel Bitcoin's volatility to your advantage. In the long run, this strategy will outperform every other Bitcoin investment strategy, probably, except for amazing luck, perhaps. The best place to do recurring purchases is OKCoin because they have the lowest fees for recurring Bitcoin purchases you will find anywhere. If you're stacking sats for the long run, every sat matters, and the fees with each purchase will add up. That's why I recommend you buy at the lowest cost possible from OKCoin. OKCoin is also the Bitcoin exchange available in the most countries around the world, so it will hopefully be accessible for you wherever you are. Go to OKCoin.com to get started with your stacking. Nodal 1. As discussed in the Bitcoin Standard, Bitcoin is controlled by the nodes that operate its software. It is only through consensus between nodes that the Bitcoin blockchain continues to live, and it is only by running a Bitcoin node that you are part of this consensus and can verify the validity of the transactions you receive and the ownership of your coins. Whenever anyone asks me what are the most important warning signs that something is wrong with Bitcoin, I always answer the following. If the number of Bitcoin nodes is declining, and or the cost of running a node is rising significantly. I believe it is really important to run a node, but I don't recommend running it on your work or personal computer as it can compromise the performance of your computer and, more importantly, the security and privacy of your Bitcoin node. A far better solution is to buy a dedicated hardware node, and for that, I highly recommend Nodal. Manage all your Bitcoin activity, such as Lightning or BTC Pay server, and isolate them from your personal computer by putting them into one dedicated device that is always running and does one thing only, Bitcoin. Become a first-class Bitcoin citizen by running your own Nodal node, available at nodal.it, and that's spelled N-O-D-L.it. Finally, Cold Card. My hardware wallet of choice is the Cold Card. I strongly recommend only conducting Bitcoin trades on computers that are dedicated to Bitcoin and cannot connect to the internet. I like the Cold Card because it is a contained machine optimized for Bitcoin.
Thank you, everybody, for coming, and thank you very much to Manuel and everybody here for organizing this talk. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here. I've been to Munich once before, and I've always thought it was the most beautiful big city that I've ever visited. I've always said this since the last time I was here, about 6 years ago, so I'm very glad to be back again. So, as mentioned in the introduction, I'm not going to be discussing Bitcoin from a technical perspective. If you want to imagine Bitcoin as a car, I'm going to be talking about the effect of a car on society and the economics of car making and things like that. We will not be talking about how to maintain your car, how to fix your car, how your car works. We will not look under the hood and look at the engine, okay? So we're just going to look at the social and economic aspects of what the car does. So, three main points that I wanted to discuss in this talk. Why Bitcoin is unique monetarily, why is, as a form of money it's unique and different from other kinds of money. Based on that, what is Bitcoin good for? What are the good applications that it can be used for? What its importance is? And then the topic of my book, A Bitcoin Standard, what would that mean? What would it look like? Where it to happen? So, these I think I'll give you a very good idea about some of the main concepts in my book. And I try to keep my presentations a little bit more general without getting into too much detail so that whatever you're interested in to getting into in more detail, we can do so in the Q&A session, whereas during the presentation, I try and keep it as general as possible so that we don't lose you don't lose attention if we get into too much detail. So, without further ado, what is it that is unique about Bitcoin? Well, to understand that, I begin by analysis of what is it that makes something money. Why do things become money and other things don't become money? And in my opinion, and based on looking at different things that become money, I think that what ends up being chosen as money in a free market is whatever is the hardest thing for people to produce. Whatever is hard for people to make more of, to increase the supply of, is naturally going to end up becoming a sort of money for the very simple reason that it will naturally and inevitably, because of the fact that it's hard to make it, it'll hold its value better than things that are very easy to make. So if people put their wealth in things that are hard to make, the other people will be able to produce less of it, and so the value will decline less. If people put their wealth, store it in things that are easy to produce, like, say, the Venezuelan dollar or like non-precious metals, once you store your money in those things, the fact that people are storing wealth in them raises their price. It raises demand for them, makes the price higher. Once the price becomes higher, that gives an incentive to producers to make more of it, and therefore, that destroys the value that goes into it. So therefore, things that can be easily made, that can be produced easily, act as terrible stores of value and don't end up gaining a monetary role. And we can see this if we apply it, you know, to national currencies as well as if we apply it to older kinds of currencies. This, what I call the easy money trap in my book, if something easy to produce gets chosen as money, the monetary demand for it rises, more production of it happens, and then its price drops. So in the long run, if we look at actual economies, we see that whatever it was the hardest thing for people to produce ended up getting chosen as money, according to the technology of the time. So earlier in ancient times, cattle were money because they're very hard to make, and people would want to get paid in cattle because you could always eat cattle. And, you know, one cow can mean survival for a family for a year. So it's very useful to have them around, and they're very hard to make, so they were used as money. But obviously, not very convenient to divide and move around and so on. So then we moved towards other things that were harder to make, like seashells or glass beads or metals. And as these things became easier to make through industrialization, for instance, and the advancement in the production of metals, within metals we moved towards only the precious metals, which are the hardest to make. And then gold effectively became money. Why? Because it is the hardest metal to make. And even amongst government money, if we look today, we see that the currencies, the national currencies whose supply increases quickly, are the ones that are not commonly used around the world. In fact, they get dumped and given up by people, as we see happening in Venezuela today, who will instead prefer to use monies that are harder to produce, like the dollar and the euro and the Swiss franc. So what they all have in common is that they are hard to make. And we see this dynamic happen, and there are a couple of stories that I mentioned in the book, where the several monies that are of different difficulties interact in a certain place. There can only be one winner. So for instance, this story of the Rhystones is a very common story amongst Bitcoiners because it's a useful way of understanding how Bitcoin works. But these were limestones that were rare, that didn't exist in an island, that didn't have limestones, an island called Yap. And they would get these limestones from Palau, an island close to them, and they were being used as money because limestone was not common in that island. But once modern industrialization came in, once an American sailor came to that island and saw that those people value those limestones a lot, he got industrial equipment and dynamite and a big ship, took it to the island that has the lime, produced a lot of the lime, took it to the island where they used the lime as money, and tried to use it as money. And the result, of course, was that it stopped being money, because once it became easy for others to bring it and flood the supply with it, the value of it collapsed and it stopped being money, and the Yap Island today has moved towards more modern forms of money. As soon as this became too easy to produce, as soon as something else, a harder form of money came into the island, people shifted to that. A similar example is with the slave beads in West Africa. West Africa was behind in terms of the ability to produce glass, and so glass beads were always very rare in West Africa. Because they were rare, they were used as money. Now, as Europeans started coming into West Africa and they noticed that these things were used as money, Europeans would start buying them in Europe very cheaply because glass production here was economical, and they would fill entire boats with them and send them to West Africa and use it to buy things. So what would that do to people in West Africa, you would imagine? They would just watch all of their wealth get bought up by Europeans who just magically managed to make money out of thin air. The result of this is that these then became known as the slave beads, because it was thanks to them that Europeans were able to buy everything to the point where they started having Africans sell each other and enslaving each other in exchange for these beads. And as a result, of course, these beads stopped being money, because anybody who used them as money witnessed their value get lost. So we see the same story with precious metals. Why is it that gold was the one that became money of all the other metals? It's not because it's yellow and shiny or pretty or any of that thing. It is fundamentally down to the fact that its supply grows at the lowest rate reliably every year. Gold's production increases the current stockpiles of gold only by about 1 to 2% every year. Why? For two reasons. Gold is very rare in Earth and very expensive to find. And secondly, and more importantly, gold doesn't corrode. So we've had thousands of years of gold production piling up. And so each new year's production is only going to be a small fraction compared to the thousands of years that we have piled up, which is not true for any other metal, because they all pile up, they all rust and lose. We lose some of the mass of them. So new production is always far more significant compared to existing stockpiles, which means that if people store their wealth in any of the other metals, it's trivial for copper producers or oil producers or iron producers to flood the market and bring the price down. But that's not possible with gold, because it's very hard to find, and it's not possible for producers to make a significant increase in the stockpiles that exist, which is why also gold mining is almost completely insignificant in terms of its effect on the price, because the quantity of gold that is bought and sold from existing holders is far larger than the new quantity that comes in from the mines. So the mines is not going to really affect the price, and that's what makes it a good monetary good. Its supply grows very, very slowly and is not very responsive to price. Even within national governments, we see, within government money, we see that the better monies are always the ones that grow at a lower rate. The average national currency between 1960 and 2015, the average national currency grew at 32.15%, which is an impressive, very fast growth rate. Of course, this includes a lot of currencies that witnessed very high percentage growth rates and during hyperinflation, but the good currencies, the reliable currencies like the dollar and the euro and the yuan, well, not the yuan, the yen and the franc, these witness economic supply growth rate at around 1, 2, 5, 10%, somewhere in the single digits. They are the ones that grow at the lower supply, and that's why their monetary role continues to increase over time, as opposed to the other currencies. So why is this important? Because if we see all of the other monies, they vary, and one of the, as I was saying, the most important metric seems to be the hardness of producing it. Well, now Bitcoin, for me, the reason it matters is because it is the hardest money that we've ever invented. And it's a completely different kind of hard from all the other kinds of money. It's a money whose supply is completely irresponsive to demand. It doesn't matter how many people demand Bitcoin, the production schedule is fixed. And that's something completely different between it and all the other kinds of money. More people demand gold, more gold will be made. More people demand silver, more silver will be made. More people demand US dollars, the US government will find a way of making more US dollars. But Bitcoin is programmed to not care about your demand. The supply grows at a decreasing rate. And the growth rate started off being very high, but is now dropping. It's around 4% per year right now. So right now already Bitcoin is growing at the rate of the reliable national currencies in terms of the supply growth rate. And within 4 years, it'll be at 2%. And about 5 years or so from now, it'll be growing at an even lower rate than the growth rate of Bitcoin. So eventually, the growth rate drops to zero. And then we get to a point where the money supply stabilizes at 21 million. And this is something quite unique about it, and we'll talk about it in a bit. So why is this, what is the uniqueness here? Is that anything that gets chosen as a store of value, as I was mentioning, will anything that gets chosen as a store of value would have more of its production happen. People will produce more of it. If anybody chooses anything as a form of money, the production of that thing will increase because people will want to take some of the extra value put into that product because of the monetary demand. So if everybody tomorrow chooses to make copper money, copper producers will start producing more copper, which will eventually bring the copper price down back. And all that the choice of people choosing money does, copper as money does, is that it will transfer wealth from the savers to the copper miners. That's it. Because copper miners can continue to increase the supply to meet all the excess demand until they bring the price down. This is true for everything except Bitcoin. If demand for Bitcoin increases, the supply for Bitcoin cannot increase. It cannot respond to it. So more production is not possible, but what happens if everybody wants to use Bitcoin or if demand for Bitcoin increases? Instead of the output of mining increasing, which is what would happen with anything else, with Bitcoin, the difficulty of mining increases and the output remains the same. And this, for me, the difficulty adjustment aspect of Bitcoin is the truly unique contribution that Bitcoin provided that makes Bitcoin work. I mean, this is like the magic sauce that makes the dish come together. So if you look at all the constituent members of the Bitcoin technology, if you read their history, you know, proof of work, for instance, was invented many years ago. Cryptography, hashing functions, all of these things are many, many years old. And many examples of digital cash had utilized many of these technologies. They were all unworkable until Nakamoto added the difficulty adjustment, this one particular thing, because this is what made the system work, because it guaranteed that there would be a fixed supply of coins. It guaranteed that nobody would be able to game the system in a way to increase the supply of coins without anybody being able to find out. So what this difficulty adjustment does is that instead of demand increasing, leading to the supply increasing, the difficulty adjustment just makes it harder to mine Bitcoin. Effectively, it makes it more expensive to make new Bitcoin, which is simply making the network more secure. Because the larger the processing power needed to write the transactions, the more expensive it is to attack the network, and the harder it is to forge the record of transactions onto the network. So, in other words, with every other money, when the value of the money goes up because people demand it as a store of value, the supply goes down, the supply goes up and the value then goes down. It's like a feedback mechanism that corrects itself. With Bitcoin, it's the opposite. It doesn't correct itself because the supply stays constant. Instead, the network becomes more secure. And so we get into this vicious cycle of, you know, the irresistible black hole that is Bitcoin, that is going to eat the entire world economy, is caused by this sort of cycle, which is self-reinforcing. If people demanded Bitcoin as a store of value, and even at very low levels, if it starts getting a little bit of demand, that causes its price to rise. But if the price rises, mining Bitcoin becomes more profitable. So people try to mine it more. But of course, mining it more doesn't create more Bitcoin. It just makes the processing power that goes towards mining higher, which means that the network becomes more secure. But if the network becomes more secure, that in turn incentivizes further use as a store of value. And so this is really how we can understand the last 9 years in which Bitcoin's price has gone up about 80 million% or something like that in 9 years. About 600% per year on average is the growth. And I think, you know, you can't really understand it except through this cycle. It's because there's no negative feedback loop of increased supply to matter with the demand, to counteract the demand. Nobody can increase the Bitcoin supply to stabilize the price. All that happens is the network becomes stronger. So the economic incentives of the system just keep driving people towards interacting with it in this way, towards making it more and more valuable, more and more secure, and it continues to hold more and more economic value. So how secure is Bitcoin as a result of this? The last time I checked, this was last week, I don't know if it went up more, but the processing power around the transactions that happen in Bitcoin, something like 500,000 transactions, is about 31 exahash per second, which is about 31 trillion hash per second, which, you know, is a lot. It's so much that, you know, it's about 4 trillion of your own laptop computer, about 4 million of the world's top supercomputer, 400,000 of the world's top 500 supercomputers combined. That's the amount of processing power that is going towards securing the Bitcoin network. So you have all these machines all over the world, combining all and doing nothing but solving the Bitcoin proof of work to ensure that it remains secure. And essentially, you can think of this as the cost of attacking Bitcoin. If you're trying to attack Bitcoin, you need to have processing power. Well, one way of attacking Bitcoin, at least, is to have high processing power to be able to overcome this. And as long as Bitcoin continues to be the single largest use of processing power that is economical in the world, the most economic use of processing power, it continues to attract more processing power, making it more and more expensive for any potential attacker to take it on. So this is really why Bitcoin is secure. It's not because it's fundamentally an economic incentive issue. It's that it's extremely expensive to attack the network because the reward for securing the network is the token of the network itself. So the increased demand goes towards increasing the processing power and making the network more secure. Further points towards understanding how secure it is, it's that, number one, it has no single point of failure. So there's no single person or individual or piece of critical hardware or infrastructure anywhere in the world that is critical for Bitcoin to continue to operate. There isn't one thing that you can shut down that would shut down Bitcoin. There isn't a single individual that you could kill to kill Bitcoin. You could kill every single computer programmer in the world that knows how to program C++, which is Bitcoin's language. Bitcoin will continue to operate. It doesn't need any of those programmers. It's effectively can't be stopped because it's just a protocol that is open for anybody to use. And about every 10 minutes, that protocol, with anybody who wants to use it in the world, makes a new bunch of transactions and it updates the record of everybody who wants to use it. So anyone who wants to join that network, all you need is a computer capable of joining the internet. And currently we have billions of these all over the world. So just one of these machines connecting to any other machines that want to implement that protocol allows the network to remain alive. So this all means the hardest money that we have ever invented, the hardest money that humans have ever made, is now effectively available for everybody worldwide who has an internet connection, which is sort of a big deal. And so to sum up effectively, this is a form of money that is gaining its value online on the market because people are choosing it. There's nobody in the world putting a gun to people's heads and telling them you have to accept Bitcoin. People are accepting Bitcoin voluntarily. And this is, according to the Austrian School of Economics, this is really the criterion of what determines good versus bad money or sound versus unsound money. Fundamentally, it is about whether the money is chosen freely on the market and whether its value is determined through people buying and selling freely versus money that is imposed on the market by force and whose value is determined by decree. So if you have to put a gun to people's head and you tell them you have to use this money and you have to accept it at this value, then obviously that's not good money, because if it was good money, they wouldn't need a gun to their head to accept it. Similarly, you know, if a restaurant has to put a gun to your head to eat their food at a certain price, it's probably not good food. And that's an excellent way of defining, you know, clarifying the difference between bad and good food, I guess. If you have to kill somebody if you have to threaten death for somebody to eat it, it can't be that good. And I think the same is true in the case of money. In other words, I think Bitcoin, because it is hard, because it is very hard to produce, it is winning the monetization race of gaining more and more value, of having more and more people store value in it, and it's winning it on the market on its own. And this brings us to what Bitcoin is good for. In my opinion, there are three main uses of Bitcoin. The first one is that it is a store of value. And the issue of the difficulty adjustment doesn't just mean that the new supply is fixed. It also, we have the idea that the total supply is fixed, so that the total quantity of Bitcoin that we're ever going to have is only going to be 21 million. And this is unique because we've never, ever had an actually scarce liquid asset before. If you think about all the others, all the other kind of liquid assets that we as humans have, all the metals and the resources that we use, we like to think of them as being scarce in that, you know, there's a limited amount of them in the earth. But that's really irrelevant. The quantity in the earth for us is kind of irrelevant because it's nowhere near being a binding limit on how much we can have from anything, right? The limit on how much we can have from, let's say, copper or nickel or zinc or gold or oil is never the quantity that is on the earth, right? It's rather how much time we dedicate to it versus other uses. So if tomorrow people decided that we need zinc much more for whatever reason, it's not impossible to double the production of zinc within a year or even triple it. It would be expensive because it would have to come at the expense of other things. So miners who are mining copper or nickel would need to switch towards mining zinc, but it can be done. In other words, the limit on how much zinc we have is not about how much zinc there is in the earth. Rather, it's about just how much time we dedicate to it. So according to an old economist called Julian Simon, the only thing that is really scarce in the world is human time. That's it. The only thing that is actually scarce is human time, because with human time, you can produce more of anything. Our only real scarcity is our time. And then allocating it into different avenues produces more of those things, whatever it is. And that's why the use of the word resource is kind of wrong linguistically when you apply it to things like oil or copper or gold or nickel, because these are not really resources. Resources implies, you know, we just order them and they just fall down from heaven. But that's not true. These things need extensive amount of time in order for them to be produced. So they're not a resource in as much as they are a product of human time, and the quantity of them is always governed by how much time we dedicate to it, the only really scarce thing. So we can think of it this way. Once you understand it that way, you can think of the search for money as being the search for the thing that is the most scarce, because it is the thing that will hold its value more over time, because other things will just be produced at larger and increasing quantities. And Bitcoin is an incredible addition to this arsenal of choices of things that we could use as a store of value. Why? Because it is the first thing that is liquid, that can be used as a store of value, that is also truly scarce. The supply of Bitcoin is not limited by how much time we have. It is limited completely. No matter how much time or effort we want to dedicate towards making more Bitcoin, we'll never get more than 21 million. But we can get more of everything else. So what this means is that finally we have something else that is strictly scarce like time, and that is Bitcoin. More of it cannot be made no matter how much effort goes into it. So for me, this means that this is natural, that this would be a good store of value. Because why do people store value? They try to store value across time. So I earn money today. I don't want to save it today. I'd like to save some of it for next year. I'm looking for something that will hold that value until next year. There can't be many things better than the one thing whose supply cannot be increased strictly, right? Other things, you could store value in them over time, but then over the next year, the supply can increase. And you can think of the increase in the supply of your store of value as being like an inefficiency. Think about it as an engine. All engines have a degree of inefficiency. In the case of the store of value, the inefficiency is the new production, which devalues the existing stockpile. So you'd like your new money to have as little inflation as possible, as little growth in the supply as possible. And I think Bitcoin, by being completely strictly scarce and fixed in terms of its supply, is likely to become a very good use as a store of value. And I like to think of it as simply our most advanced technology for transferring value across time into the future. If you want to buy wealth, if you want to buy value next year, if you want to have something to spend next year, arguably, most likely, the cheapest, most efficient way of buying it is to buy the thing that can't be inflated over that period, the thing whose supply is the most predictable. And that's why I think Bitcoin is a remarkable technology as a store of value, and that's why its value continues to go up. Or also, that's, you know, the fact that its value continues to go up also makes it that. So it's a reinforcing cycle. Secondly, what Bitcoin is good for, I think the second aspect of it is that it's going to reinvigorate individual sovereignty, increase the amount of individual freedom that people have at the expense of governments. The way that I look at it, and I discuss this in depth in my book, the 20th century was the century in which governments took over the production of money, and they started central banking, and they started printing money. And during that century, this was inseparable from the growth of the power of the government. Government suddenly became capable of controlling almost every aspect of society's life. It almost goes without thinking for us that, you know, government's supposed to help the poor and tell us what to drink and eat and smoke and how to have sex and who it is okay to have sex with. You know, we think that those things are just simply the job of the government, that the government needs to decide them. And if you actually think about it historically, generally this wasn't much of the case. I mean, this was maybe the job of religion, but it was to a very large extent separated from the monetary policy. But once you put people in charge of the morality and security and the economy, plus they have the ability to print money at will to finance their operation, you know, what you get is the 20th century. What you get is just all these governments growing and having more and more and more power over the citizens and being able to exercise enormous amount of control over people's lives. And we saw the terrible cost this had all over the world. So Bitcoin rebalances that. There's more discussion of this in detail in the book. On the short run, thinking about the effect that it has, right now, you know, it's harder to confiscate Bitcoin. It's easy to send it around the world. And it allows everybody in anywhere in the world to have a place where they can store their value, largely safer from their government, or at least safer from where they would have it in the bank. And this isn't much of a problem for people living in places like Germany today, but you know, a few years ago we saw it was a problem for people in Greece and Cyprus, and today it's a problem in Zimbabwe and Venezuela. But I think the more important aspect of this is that in the long run, is that if more and more people continue to use Bitcoin as a store of value, that means less and less people store value in government money. That gives government less and less ability to finance itself through inflation. And this, I think, is one of the key, if not the key, the key change to the world that Bitcoin is going to make, which is that it's going to make finance through inflation become harder and possibly impossible. And therefore, government finance will have to come from taxation. In other words, governments will have to earn money, have it in their pocket first before they spend it. And I think this would be an enormous change in the way that governments function today, because the only way that they can continue with this system of continuous debt is through the monetization of debt, and it is through the increase of the supply of money. So I think if we are able to remove that, we're going to have an extremely different 21st century from the 20th century. More generally, and this is the main topic of my book, Bitcoin is emerging as a decentralized free market alternative to central banking and gold. This is really, I think, what it is about. So yeah, people are using it as a store of value, and it is giving people more sovereignty and control over their own finances and independent of the government. But the really dangerous thing to imagine is that this is being systematically implemented into a new form of monetary policy. You can think of it as if we've just introduced a new country into the world, and that country has its own independent monetary policy. That country is called the Internet, and its monetary policy is the Bitcoin algorithm. And this new country, you know, unlike all the other countries competing with the US dollar, you can't shut this country down. You can't bring them democracy, you can't invade them, you can't do all of the things that the US government usually does to its competitors. So it's just an option that exists freely on the internet, and anybody is free to join it. It's this country that anybody can join from anywhere and join their monetary policy. And, you know, central banks have for 100 years maintained their monopoly as the only system for sending value across the world through government enforcement. It was a monopoly enforced at gunpoint. I mean, but that was only doable because physical clearance requires physical infrastructure, which governments can then capture. So now we have an alternative of a system that's completely digital. There are no physical infrastructure or resources part of Bitcoin that you can target in order to destroy it. Anybody in the world now, if you want to send money in the world, when you want to send money somewhere else, if you want to send money to China today, you know, your only options today are to go through the central banking monopoly, one way or the other. You have to go through central banks, and all of the central banks of today have to go through one central bank, which is the US Federal Reserve. And so you have, this is your only option for sending money around the world, going through that monopoly. Now we have an alternative. And going through that monopoly and going through a few specific currencies, the dollar, the euro, the Swiss franc, the yen, and the British pound, plus the IMF, SDRs, and gold. Those are really the only currencies that you can send across the world. So now we have an alternative, which is a new currency and a new monetary system for sending things across the world. And this is completely decentralized and completely free market. Now, the interesting thing about it is that You know, up until a year or two ago, the majority of people used to think Bitcoin is not going to scale. Bitcoin, you know, the idea that Bitcoin was going to emerge as a new monetary system is impossible because Bitcoin can only handle 500,000 transactions a day. So therefore, it's going to always remain as a little niche thing, you know, maybe used by drug dealers, maybe used by Venezuelans trying to exit from inflation. But you can't run a monetary system on 500,000 transactions a day. I mean, one neighborhood in Munich probably has 500,000 transactions a day. So you can't run the entire world on something like that. But instead, what we've seen over the last year, as Bitcoin transactions hit that upper limit of, well, you could say 500,000, it could go up maybe to 1 million, maybe 2 millions. But, you know, there's a hard limit somewhere in that range. And it is nowhere near enough the amount of transactions needed for the entire world economy, let alone an entire city. So how can you then have Bitcoin grow and scale if there's this limit on this transaction? And what we've seen over the last year or two, and what is inspiring the title of my book, is that Bitcoin is growing the same way that the gold standard has grown, in that if you remember how the gold standard used to work, it didn't involve people carrying gold around in their pockets everywhere and paying with physical gold everywhere. Gold was stored in vaults in banks, and banks issued gold-backed receipts or certificates or checks or different forms of financial instruments that were backed by that gold that were then used. So as a result, an ounce of gold would stay in the bank vault, and for every 10,000 maybe transactions or 100 transactions, 1,000 transactions that take place with a piece of paper backing that ounce of gold, maybe every 1,000 times the piece of paper moves around, the physical gold ounce moves once, right? When this bank needs to settle with that bank, we take some of the gold and we move them there. Or when this central bank wants to settle at the end of the month or the year with another central bank, they'll move some of their gold there. But the majority of transactions happen, if you want, on a second layer. They are backed by the gold. The gold is there. And you don't need to move the gold ounce every time you want to pay somebody. So obviously, when I pay for a restaurant, my bank isn't going to move the gold bar from my account to their bank and their account with every meal, right? The end of the day, the end of the week, or the end of the month, they settle amongst each other, and they cross out all the payments and see who has a balance, and then they settle it. So one settlement transaction can proxy for thousands of individual consumer transactions, and this is what we're beginning to see happen with Bitcoin right now. As the capacity of transactions began to get full, the transaction costs rose, and so people who used it started batching their transactions and started doing more transactions on second layer. So now Bitcoin exchanges, Bitcoin gambling websites, all websites that offer Bitcoin services, what they now do is, it used to be that, you know, when you would have an account with them, and let's say I would transfer money from my account to your account on their platform, it used to be that they would have that transaction on the Bitcoin blockchain, which is effectively like moving the digital gold, the physical gold from one place to the other. Today, they net out those transactions on their system, and then they only do the external transactions at the end of the day, and then they settle with one another. So in other words, we're moving towards a world in which each actual Bitcoin transaction proxies for several other second layer transactions being built around it. In other words, Bitcoin is not moving towards becoming a consumer technology for payments. Rather, it is becoming a technology for settlement of high volume payments between financial institutions rather than between individuals. In other words, Bitcoin's transactions can't be compared to you buying a coffee with your credit card, because that's like trying to use your Concorde airplane for going to the grocery store. It's completely wrong application of the technology, in that, you know, what you need for the credit card for you to buy your lunch is, okay, some level of security, but, you know, if the level of security of your credit card is 99% and the restaurant is going to get robbed of one out of 100 lunches per every time they make 100 meals, they're going to have one fraudulent meal, that's okay. I mean, obviously it's not ideal, but, you know, one fraud in that kind of transaction is not a big deal. But if there's going to be fraud in your bank's settlement with a German central bank, you know, that's not a risk worth taking, okay? So Bitcoin, any Bitcoin transaction, you can't really consider it settled before, I'd say, at least 30, 40 minutes. And so you shouldn't be waiting for your food for 30, 40 minutes for the Bitcoin transaction to clear, obviously. And you don't need to wait 30, 40 minutes because the level of security of a Bitcoin transaction is not required for your lunch transaction. It's more like a settlement transaction. So in other words, all the current payment solutions that we have, like credit cards and checks and paper money even, they can be used with Bitcoin. But if Bitcoin itself is used as the settlement layer, and these come as a second layer of transactions. So while over time on-chain Bitcoin transactions or actual full Bitcoin transactions might increase, you know, they'll go up by another 500,000, another million or so, but they can only increase gradually, marginally, small, tiny, little increases. Off-chain transactions or second layer transactions can increase exponentially. You know, any day we could wake up and find that new banks and new payment solutions are being added, and then more and more volume is happening with Bitcoin trading. So as Bitcoin and as people want to use it more as a store of value, it becomes more and more liquid because more people are willing to accept it as payments, and more solutions are beginning to develop for using it as a second layer settlement for it. So we're seeing it becoming more and more like what the gold standard used to do. And so, interestingly enough, I want to end what is Bitcoin good for with this quote by Friedrich Hayek from 1984, you know, before probably the guy who invented Bitcoin was able to read, if not alive. And he said, "I don't believe we shall ever have a good money before we take the thing out of the hands of governments. We can't take it violently out of the hands of governments. All we can do is by some sly roundabout way introduce something that they can't stop." Astonishing to read this in 1984 because 25 years later, really, it really was a very sly, very roundabout way, very complicated way. For those of you who have tried to make sense of how Bitcoin works, it's not going to happen in a day or a week. It'll be at least a few months of trying to understand how it works. It's very roundabout, very complicated. But the point behind this complicated design is that it is something that they can't stop. It's something that just can't be legislated away. And that's really the driving, yani, that's really the engineering motivation of it, you know? If you think about, you know, when an engineer sits down to make a sports car, the motivation is we want to make this fast. It's a safety family car, we want to make this safe. With Bitcoin, the motivation was not we want to make it fast payments or we want to make high volume payments. We just want to make it impossible to kill. We just make it impossible for governments to shut it down. That's really the key design imperative for it, and this is how it was conceived. So this is why I think it's important, because it's basically giving us as a society the option of using hard money and sound money that is free from government control for the first time in about 100 years, because it introduces something that they cannot stop and so is not subject to their monopoly. Now, I'm going to just discuss what I think about the economic implications. If, just hypothetically speaking, if this Bitcoin economy, if this country that is the internet continues to grow so that its own currency takes over the world, or if you want to assume that this currency just continues to exist as its own country, how would that country, Internet Stan, let's call it, where people who, citizens of that country voluntarily use Bitcoin as their own money, how would that country differ? What is the value of having money that is hard? In my opinion, the most important aspect of money, the most important implication of money is time preference. And time preference refers to the ratio at which people discount the future compared to the present. So someone who has a high time preference prepares the present a lot more than the future. Someone who has a low time preference prefers the present a little more than the future. Okay? High time preference means people who are unable to think too much of long-term implications and are focused on the immediate implication. So they're people who want immediate gratification. They can't delay their gratification. They can't think about what's better in the long run. They're thinking mostly about the present. And this is a very important psychological concept, and there's a lot of evidence about how important it is for individual achievement and for individual outputs, that people who have lower time preference are able to just control themselves much better in all kinds of aspects of life, whether it's work, money, personal relationships. Being able to think of the long term changes the way that you behave about everything. And in fact, you can really see the linkage between this and money in a very simple idea, which is that if your money is losing its value, which is what easy money does because it's continuously being produced in increasing quantities, if that happens, if your money is increasing its value, what does that do to you? What does it do in terms of your decision in terms of consumption versus spending, consumption versus saving? It's more likely to make you want to consume. It's less likely to make you want to save. Why would you want to save if your money is going to lose value over time? On the other hand, if the money gains value over time, you become more likely to save it, less likely to spend it. Another way of understanding this relationship, of course, is through the interest rate, because the interest rate is the price of money. So when you have easy money whose supply is constantly increasing, or when the central bank increases the money supply, what happens to interest rates? They drop. When interest rates are low, that lowers people's incentives for saving and increases their incentives for borrowing and consumption. And the opposite goes when interest rates are high. If interest rates are high, people are more likely to save, less likely to borrow. So the result, in my opinion, is that an increase in the value of money through harder money is going to lead towards people moving towards more and more of long-term thinking financially in terms of saving more and consuming less. Now, this, of course, is brings us to the main objection that Keynesians usually have to Bitcoin, which is that Bitcoin is deflationary money, and if we ran an economy on deflationary money, then the economy would come crashing down. Why? Because, as I was saying, nobody would want to spend money that gains value over time. And so if people stop spending, what happens to the economy? It stops working. You know, in the Keynesian view, the economy is just like a machine. And it's like when people stop spending, it's like you took the electricity away from the machine, and the machine stops. And then we all die, unless the Keynesians step in and inflate the money supply and bring us, you know, stop us from being able to save, and so then force us to save and then save us. That's sort of how the Keynesian story goes. But of course, you know, there's a problem with this, which is if your money, value of your money goes up, your time preference drops. It becomes low, but it isn't eliminated. In other words, no matter how much your money will appreciate next year, you're still not going to go hungry this year waiting for it to appreciate next year, for the very simple reason that you would die if you tried to not eat anything this year in order to just eat next year, right? So if I told you that your money will gain 5% versus lose 5%, yes, you're likely to spend less, but you're not going to spend zero. So there will still be spending in an economy where the money appreciates. The difference is that people will be much more careful about what they spend and will only spend in things that gain value. And so the key point is that hard money will lower time preference, but it does not eliminate it. According to the Keynesian story, time preference is essentially almost eliminated if the money gains value, and so nobody wants to spend anything, and people will just wait. But of course, you know, not just one way of explaining why that doesn't work is the example I gave in terms of food. Another one is electronics. I'm sure all of you have noticed by now that your electronics keep getting cheaper. The phone that you bought today, the same phone, you can buy next year for half the price, right? So why did you buy it? Couldn't you have waited 1 year? Why not wait 5 years? You get it much cheaper. Think about the phone that you got 5 years ago. How much you paid for it 5 years ago? Today you can buy the same phone for $5. Why did you buy it 5 years ago? Well, why? Because you needed to use it throughout those 5 years. And now it would be nicer if you could buy it for $5 5 years ago, but you couldn't because that was the price back then. So even though the price of your computer is going down all the time, people still buy it. This is a hard drive, 10 megabyte hard drive from 1980, and it costs $3,500. Today, you can't even buy a 10 megabyte hard drive. They don't exist anymore. But if you found one, you'd probably get it for free. So why did people in 1980 buy this and not just wait 30 years and then buy it for a few cents and save $3,494.9 on it? Well, because they needed it throughout those 30 years, and they don't need it towards the end. We as human beings don't live forever. Our time on Earth is finite. And at any point in time, you can get hit by a bus and die and then never get this. So therefore, you want to preserve your life, so you will spend on food, you will spend on keeping yourself alive, and you value present consumption over future consumption. Easy money, or money which loses its value, makes you value present consumption even more. Hard money will make you value present consumption even a little bit less, but it'll still be valued more than future consumption. So therefore, The effect is not going to be that we're going to have an economy where people don't spend and then the economy collapses. The result is people are going to spend less on stupid nonsense that they don't need, like all the stupid plastic stuff that everybody spends all their money buying today and replacing next month. And instead, they will save their money, invest it, and accumulate wealth over time. Now, the missing part of the Keynesian story is that, you know, when people decide not to spend, it's not as if, you know, there was this economic manna from heaven that they were going to do, which is spending, and now it's gone and it's evaporated. If people are not spending, that means that the resources that were going to go towards providing those consumer goods that they were going to consume, instead of making those consumer goods, they are now going to be utilized into capital structure, into the production of long-term goods. In other words, the only reason that we can actually get capital production, the only reason that we can get capital accumulation is, in the first place, reduced consumption. Only when you stop consuming all of the corn that you have can you start growing some corn and putting it into the ground. And the opportunity cost of consuming it is that you can't invest it. So the result of reduced consumption and the result of low time preference is capital accumulation. In fact, low time preference, German economist Hans Hermann Hoppe calls it, it's what initiates the process of civilization. It's what really allows us as human beings to begin the process of civilization. When we delay our gratification from, you know, wanting to satisfy our immediate needs and starting thinking about future needs and how we can improve them. So the first, the first person who stopped just hunting animals with their own hands and started instead building an arrow or a bow and arrow or a net or something to catch fish with, that was the first capitalist. And that's really what was the beginning of the story of civilization. Because we started thinking, instead of just going and running after the animal and trying to catch it and spending 10 hours trying to catch it, if we spend those 10 hours building a machine, we could then catch each animal in 1 hour. And so our productivity increases. So this is the process of capital accumulation. But for it, what needs to be done is a lower time preference. What needs to be done is to have people save and think of the future. So for me, Bitcoin standard or hard money, if we get back to a hard money system, we'll witness more saving, more capital accumulation, which leads to higher productivity. You know, the fisherman who has a boat has a much higher productivity than the fisherman who tries to catch fish with their own hand, which keeps leading to better material living standards. And of course, you know, the best example of this is Europe under the gold standard in the 19th century. This was an economy that had hard money. The money supply was not easy to increase. And yet, if you look all across Europe, you know, this was the flourishing of the Industrial Revolution. This was when some of the most important inventions of our modern world, we like to think of them as being from the 20th century, but really, they all came from that golden period towards the end of the 19th century. It was called La Belle Époque. And all over the world, you know, people mostly thrived. It was an era of peace. There was very little war, and there was very little government control. And the economy of almost everywhere in the world was thriving and growing because everybody was on more or less hard money. The implications of time preference, in my opinion, are not just economic. And this is a part of my book that's, it's not very common to read things like this, but really, I think it's no coincidence that if you look at the art of, say, Michelangelo, that came in a period where gold was money. All of the best art that you see in the world comes from periods of hard money. If you look at the art that we see being produced today, at periods of easy money, I don't think it's an entirely coincidence that the masterpieces of today, the most expensive things being produced today, on average take about 20 minutes to produce, and the skill level of something like a 10-year-old child. I mean, you think about the artwork that used to be produced 500 years ago, and it would take days and months and years for people to do it. I mean, Michelangelo, he hung from the roof of the Sistine Chapel for 4 years, all day. Sometimes he would sleep there and spend several days there with very little food, hanging from the ceiling in order to draw the Sistine Chapel. This is what low time preference does. You know, you have in your mind, I'd like to draw this, but it would take 4 years to finish it. What do? You spend 4 years hanging from the ceiling. Now today, Damien Hirst or any of these modern artists, who of those people can you imagine spending 4 years working on anything? You know, the artwork that they sell for tens of millions of dollars literally takes 20 minutes to recreate. It can be done in 20 minutes. And I think This is no coincidence. We don't have chapels being built with the Sistine Chapel anymore. We don't have churches being built today like the churches of the past that took the many, many decades to complete. And I think the same is true with music. You know, when 100 to 200 years ago, people used to compose music that took a lot of time to compose and a lot of time to listen to. Today, it's essentially all an auto-generated online. It takes 3 minutes to listen to the song, 2 minutes to forget that you ever heard it. And it's just a constant churn of very low quality, many songs being reproduced. I give many examples about things related to this, but I think it's not a coincidence that we see these things repeat themselves. And I would imagine that a society that starts to head more towards hard money will find its art and everything about its temperament also shift towards being of a higher quality and the lower time preference. And you know, one way of looking at this is, when money is hard, the people who finance art are people who have succeeded in the world of money. So you have to have done something right, and that means, you know, your intelligence or your time preference at least is above the average. You're a person who's capable of thinking of the long term and saving money across generations, and those people get to dictate how art happens. Now think about what dictates what is art today. If you look at, I know about the U.S. and Britain. You know, I don't know what it's like in Germany, but there are art councils funded by the government, and they decide what is art. So the story becomes completely different, because now money is very easy. So government just prints money, creates governing bodies that go around and tell people what to put in their museums, as opposed to, you know, instead of having the Medicis financing Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo, we now have government agencies financing all this kind of art that we see. So I think this is, in my opinion, the most important implication of a move towards a Bitcoin economy. I think it's going to really change us culturally and civilizationally towards going back to how people were under the gold standard. It will reduce the amount of power that the government has and force people to think more about the long run. So the first one is, and the second topic is limited government. In other words, if you think about it, after the Industrial Revolution, the capital and the most productive things in the world were physical, and they were easy to put into limited space. So under the feudalist era, you know, the most productive resource was land, and so it was spread out. And so the best sort of way of organizing that, or the most efficient way of organizing it, was the feudal system, where one person had a small army and they had large amounts of land. But as we moved towards industrialization, physical capital was concentrated in smaller areas. So you now have a factory, or you have a group of factories in a city. So it's pretty straightforward for an army to take them over and control them. And that's why industrialization led to the rise of the nation state, because industrialization centralized production and economic value in a place that is easy for nation states to come and capture. Now, if we look at the world and with Bitcoin, you know, we see wealth, as well as a lot of the economic activity and the economic value, is purely informational. So if you think about it, you know, whether you think of this bank or even an engineering company, even what gives, say, Mercedes-Benz value is not so much the machines and the actual physical capital that they have, and as much as it is the intangible capital, the brand name, the experience, all of these things that they've acquired over many, many years. And more and more and more of our economy is about information. More and more and more of the people who work today produce nothing substantial physical. They produce information in one shape or the other. So as more of economic activity becomes information, and now the money that is used to transact it is purely informational, the ability of government to confiscate economic production and control it is reduced. In other words, we get back to a point where governments, instead of having divided the world into something like 200 monopolies where they could just capture all the wealth that lives on their land, now wealth and capital are very easy to move around. So they can't just put a gun to your head and tell you, no, you have to stay here. What we're going to see more and more of is that they need to compete to attract wealth and capital. In other words, it's going to be very easy for you to lose a lot of wealth and capital if you're not good towards your citizens. And therefore, the only way around that is for governments to start competing instead of competing on introducing better rules to attract capital. And so I think this would lead to growth of things like limited government and a return to something like what I like to call the Swissification of the world. We'd go back to, or we'd move towards an economic political system like Switzerland, where simply the government rarely matters and barely even exists. Finally, the economic aspect of it that I think that is also very interesting is hard money, from the Austrian perspective, is the solution to the business cycle. Now, this sounds crazy, but really, if you study the Austrian business cycle, according to their perspective, and I agree with this fully, a business cycle, a recession, is just the inevitable outcome of interest rate manipulation. In the same way that if you had a price control over apples tomorrow in Munich, you're going to get shortages or surpluses in apple production. If you have price controls over the price of capital, which is the interest rate, you're going to get problems reflected in the economy, and these are going to be of the form of the business cycle. And one piece of data which I've never seen anybody mention ever before is, you know, the closest thing we have to a gold standard in the 20th century was Switzerland up until the 1970s. And if you look at their economy up until the 1970s, they simply had no unemployment. There was no such a thing as unemployment. Unemployment rarely ever went above 0.2% or something like that until the 1970s. In the 1970s, effectively, Switzerland stopped really being on a gold standard. They had to, because, you know, the whole world moved off of Bretton Woods. And then in the 1990s, Switzerland sold half of its gold reserve. And you can see since then, they've just become like any other modern economy with interest, with unemployment, you know, between 2 and 5%, if they're lucky. And who knows, it might get much worse. I don't think this is an entirely a coincidence. And, you know, there's a reason why if you look back at economic data from the 18th and 19th century, there was no such thing as unemployment. That economic term did not exist until after the creation of central banks and manipulation of interest rates. Before then, there were two kinds of people: people who wanted to work, who worked, and people who didn't want to work, and they didn't work. This notion of people who want to work but are continuously being dislocated from the labor force because of, you know, recessions and these things, it did not exist. You don't get systematic failures according to this, because these things are simply the result of interest rate manipulation. And another major benefit of having a functioning price mechanism around the neutral standard like Bitcoin is that we get rid of this incredibly stupid invention that is national currencies for each part of the world. I mean, this is the economic equivalent of uninventing the wheel. It's imagine we've invented the wheel and now look at how fast cars can go. Well, let's see if we can make things better if we put square wheels on those cars and see how they go. The importance of money is that it is one medium of exchange, so that everybody exchanges their goods for the one thing, and then that allows you to just not have to worry about buying what the other person wants. That's why we invented money, so that we got rid of barter. And by the end of the 19th century, the entire planet was on gold as money, and that was a beautiful thing. It allowed for great division of labor and the growth of trade around the world in the 19th century. And then after that, since we've moved towards a world in which we have national currencies, we can think of this economic system as being a system of international barter. It's partial barter. If you want to buy something from Switzerland today, you don't just buy that thing. You have to first buy the Swiss franc of the person in Switzerland, and then use that Swiss franc to buy their thing. So that's two transactions. That's an extra level. And, you know, it's not just, okay, well, 2% is lost. If you think about it, the foreign exchange market is about 25 times the size of GDP, of world GDP, because all of those transactions, you know, so much of the world is built around trade internationally, and every one of these transactions needs to involve a foreign exchange market. So more and more and more, this is becoming more important. The fluctuations in currency prices, as I'm sure you know, are becoming a more important aspect of a business's survival, perhaps, than its own fundamentals. You know, Brexit affected so many businesses around the world, not for anything political that it did, simply because of the variation in the exchange rate. Suddenly, a lot of British producers became much more profitable. A lot of competitors became unable to compete on the market. You know, and this is a major disaster, if you think about it, for producers who spend 20, 30 years building a competitive advantage and then watching their competing country devalue their currency by 20%, suddenly the 30 years that you've spent building your competitive advantage are gone because the other country has devalued their currency. So it's as a business, more and more and more businesses starting to worry and think about foreign exchange when it really should not be their business. So, and finally, in terms of politically, you know, being able to have a monetary standard that does not get issued by a government will, I think, give the world unprecedented peace, or precedented in terms of how it was in the gold standard era, in that finally we no longer have a military that runs on an endless money printer and therefore faces no restraints on its ability to attack the world. And now, of course, I'm talking about the US. So this, I think, is also another major value from Bitcoin. It's politically neutral. And for me as an economist, I think the best part about it is it will completely save us from this voodoo science that is called monetary policy, of all these people who get together in meetings in weird rooms with weird customs and traditions, and you know, they invoke the ghosts of dead economists and they come up with magic numbers for interest rate and money supply. These ancient tribal traditions are going to die in the 21st century, and our grandchildren are going to laugh at us that we had, you know, people trying to make monetary policy like we laugh at people who use Ouija boards or something like that. Monetary policy would just become automated. There's this algorithm, and it's going to make this much new money, and that's it. And there's no role really for monetary policy to affect the money supply, because fundamentally any quantity of money is enough. And all the people's market decisions should be about their own production and not the production of money. So this, I think, for me is exciting because it gives us the option of a free market in money, savings, capital, and investments. That is all for me. This is my contact information, and my book is now available online and I think in some bookstores around here as well. Thank you so much.